Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deb Ron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of June. Our main topic for today is the second part of Birding by Ear, an encore show recorded a little over 2 years ago with birder extraordinaire Dr. Fred Sharp. And our sound engineer extraordinaire, Charlie Fleischman, has graciously agreed to help me review our general observations for the week, along with upcoming events. Welcome, Charlie.
Always good to be here, Deborah, and thank you.
But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for our mystery sound this week is that it is one of the calls that we covered in part one of our program. So your chances are very good of identifying it if you've been doing your homework and learning your bird calls this past month. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. My most exciting natural history observation of the week was almost running into a black bear out in the field a few days ago. I was hiking in along a decommissioned road, which has a lot of young Doug firs coming up alongside it. I heard this crashing sound and saw this freshly shredded bark, and I was like, oh no. So I knew that it was a black bear, and I started making a lot of noise. I knew that it wanted to encounter me even less than I wanted to encounter it. So I never did see it, but I could hear it. And then it made me curious about when it is that they feed on trees. So when I got home, I looked up some information on black bear feeding habits on the Washington Department of Wildlife website. They've got a really good website called Living with Wildlife. And here's some of what they had to say. On young conifers, especially Douglas firs, bears will rip strips of bark off with their teeth to reach insects or the sweet-tasting sap found inside. They typically do this from April through July, but the results of it can be seen all year.
Sugar concentrations vary depending on the tree species and the season. For instance, bears generally forage on hemlock before Douglas fir, which probably reflects an earlier flush of nutrients in the hemlocks. Similarly, bears may have sampled a tree early in the spring, only to return a few weeks later and strip it, presumably when sugar concentrations are greater. Bears use their claws or their teeth to strip bark from a tree, then feed on the sapwood, the newly formed outer wood, by scraping it from the heartwood, the older central wood, with their teeth. Scattered remnants of bark strewn at the base of a tree and vertical tooth marks indicate bear activity.
Bears usually forage on the lower trunk of trees, girdling the bottom 1 to 1.5 meters. What I saw was higher up in the tree, up to about 25 feet up, and some bears may climb the tree and sit on the branches to feed higher up. A single bear can strip bark from as many as 70 trees per day. If you see this kind of damage on a tree, it isn't always a bear. Porcupines can strip a tree's bark in a very similar manner, and we do have porcupines on the Olympic Peninsula, but they are rare here, while black bears are common.
Bears are omnivores. They eat both plants and animals, but their diet mostly consists of vegetation. In summer, they typically add ants, bees, grubs, and a host of other emerging plants to their diet, and then add berries and other fruit in midsummer through the fall.
Orca Network has the following news to share. After a beautiful and wonderfully full spring with the North Puget Sound gray whales and new friends, it appears that they've all left in the past few days, heading for their Arctic feeding grounds. We look forward to their return in 2019.
Biggs transient orcas are all around the Salish Sea, including most days with many matrilines in Puget Sound and Admiralty Inlet. Humpbacks are coming inland in numbers throughout the Salish Sea, but southern resident orca continue to be seen in alarmingly few numbers.
Keep your eyes out, for there are young animals emerging everywhere. My neighbor Janlyn Robinson told me that she thinks that my dog saved a deer fawn from predators last week. She heard a big kerfuffle and then found a fawn curled up hiding nearby, while my other neighbors, George and Julia Maynard, have seen a coyote pair with at least one pup in tow in the area. I saw a bobcat kit crossing the road up the Big Quilcene River a couple of times last week, which was a real treat, bounding along. And I also saw the first ruffed grouse chicks of the season, accompanied by their very protective mother running alongside them. And now for our main topic, we're back to the amazing world of birds, where Fred Sharp will continue to speak with us about the wonders of birdsong. Our first set is the Wren family. They're some of my favorites.
Amazing songsters, tiny little guys, but man, can they belt it out. And first one here to celebrate is the remarkable winter wren.
Or now called the Pacific Wren, right?
You bet. What a fabulous long cadence of the little winter wren.
I think they might be my favorite bird ever. They're just this pint-sized, perky little thing,
yeah,
and they just belt out this amazingly beautiful song.
Big attitude, over 100 individual notes in that lovely, long, flowing cadence, and very common nesting around our forest understories, both mixed and coniferous understories. You'll see the young flitting out about the nest in a few weeks. Remarkable little songster.
They're just so faithful. They're here year-round doing their thing.
Yep. Often nesting in woody debris and in root wads, even occasionally taking to nest boxes.
And to compare it to, we have next the...
the lovely house wren. The cheery house wren, it's fast, it's loud, and it's much more of a specialist of dry areas here on the Olympic Peninsula. We get them predominantly around Squim and Port Townsend, occasionally extending down far south as Quilacene, but they really like the dry forested edges, dry coniferous edges, and a bit of thickets, but definitely a specialty of the northeast Olympic Peninsula.
Well, and I heard the first one in my neighborhood, the first pair, a few weeks ago, and I'd never heard them before, but it was in a neighbor's area that was just a little bit drier than my own.
Yep, dry open sites. Scott Gremmel, who's been doing quite a bit of work, he works for the Park Service, and he's been looking at songbird communities, and he finds that house wrens can extend fairly high up in elevation, colonizing sites that have been recently visited by wildland fire.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
It's part of the natural change in avian communities. It's nice to see that the park is pursuing, where they can, safely a let-burn policy in some of the interior forest areas and opening up habitat for some of these native earlier successional species.
And the third one in the set is the Buick's wren.
Perhaps the shrillest of our three species of wrens that we commonly have in the area after the Pacific wren and the house wren is this medium-sized wren with the perky little tail.
And a really dramatic white eyebrow, right?
Dramatic eyebrow, eyeline, and it's got a little bit of a curved bill, extremely sassy, able to celebrate the pair nesting under your porch.
That's right, and it's scolding, too, particularly when they're defending their nest site. They have a powerful scold. And set two is the flycatchers. And the flycatchers are especially interesting to get the calls down because even if you can get a visual of them, you often cannot tell what you've got because they look so similar. But the calls are really quite distinctive.
And this is definitely one of my favorites. Beautiful. Whip three beers. And You often hear these calls drifting far across Olympic landscapes. They will nest right here, basically in town, in the Quimper Wildlife Corridor, in the large Grand Fir, but they'll also get them right up to treeline, usually in the drier parts of the park, the dry Northeast Olympics. Flycatchers are part of a group of birds that can be quite assertive when it comes to nesting and guarding their nest sites. I've had a few times hiking up Olympic trails, having them come down and come and scold you.
And, the olive-sided
flycatchers, uh-huh. And I feel kind of honored by that. Just keep it moving along, and it's all good. Yeah, lovely bird to have. And these flycatchers, you know, as their name implies, they specialize in hunting from perches and sallying forth and grabbing insects out of the air and going back to their perch. And oftentimes they like large, complex canopies because that creates the natural canopy gaps and interior spaces that the birds use and hunt when they fly out into these little semi-open areas within the forest.
So how does their habitat differ from our next species, the Pacific Slope?
The Pacific Slope flycatcher is also a supreme generalist found across Olympic Forest.
And they're even more common than the olive-sided, right? I mean, they just are all over the place. Once you start to listen for them, that was one that I finally learned a few years ago, and I was like, they are everywhere. And I never realized before how common they were.
The Pacific Slope Flycatcher, they make that beautiful call, and they make a variety of little tings and notes, and sort of like the Townsend's Warbler, they're so abundant that if you're attentive when you're hiking along our trails, it almost seems like the ambient noise level, we call it noise, but it's actually these birds can be very numerous and making their little ting sounds and truly define Olympic forests from sea level up to the subalpine, the Pacific Slope Flycatcher.
The third one in our set.
One more of these lovely flycatchers is the Hammond's Flycatcher. And you'll notice its call is a little bit drier and what I call burrier than the Pacific Slope Flycatcher. The Hammonds are very common at mid-elevation in the drier Northeast Olympics. You'll hear lots of these if you're attentive when you're doing your summer hikes.
Yeah, it's one that I need to learn, and I'm sure that I have heard it but just haven't been trained to hear it. So it's a good one for me to brush up on. And our third set are ones that most of you will know, at least a couple of these. We're going to start with the lovely native band-tailed pigeon.
Great bird, great native, large bird in our forests. You can occasionally get them here in winter, but they pretty much migrating in a little bit earlier than this, usually in April, and you'll hear their distinctive hooting.
And some people mistake them for an owl, but once you start to hear, they really sound way more like a dove than they do an owl.
Indeed. And they're pretty generalists in their choice of breeding habitats. You'll find them in a variety of different communities, all the way up to subalpine. And they make a variety of other distinctive sounds, too. Their wingtips tend to collide on takeoff, and they have some burry, little almost purrs that they make.
That wing flap sound.
Wing flapping sounds, very typical. And in the late summer and fall, you'll see them gathering around red elderberries and other, even coming back, dropping down to the ground at times to feed on berries. Lovely bird to have in our forests.
And the second one is a bird that we have not had here for very long, but is becoming increasingly common, right?
Indeed. The Eurasian collared dove, also known as the Bahama turtle dove, has taken North America by storm, and within the last 10 or 15 years, it has rapidly increased and moved out across North America, and we have them up in Alaska now, where I see them in the summer, and many points in between.
I didn't realize they were up in Alaska now.
They're getting around.
And just over and over and over and over.
Yeah, that's the one you can easily confuse with a barred or spotted owl. It's got that very distinctive hooting. I know out at Nash's farm last fall, we had like 40 or 50 of them in one of his apple trees in the end of summers. they're definitely a new denizen of our avifauna that's most likely here to stay. But they seem to be behaving themselves.
Yeah, they're not aggressive.
They don't seem to be displacing other birds, as far as I can tell, at food resources, and seem to be taking things sort of on the periphery and often keep to humanized or suburban or rural areas as opposed to moving into more pristine habitats.
Uh-huh. And the third in the set is the mourning dove.
How beautiful is that?
You think of it as sunset, just or early morning.
Indeed, and you'll see them oftentimes around our oaks and some of our more wild open habitats. They have a very beautifully long pointed tail when they take flight, often giving that distinctive colliding wingtips sound when they take flight, but a really lovely native dove.
And our fourth set that we are going to talk about are the finches. And the first one is a purple finch.
These little purple finches almost sounds like you're rewinding a reel-to-reel tape at fast speed.
And that's a perfect description, isn't it? If people could remember what it was like to have like a cassette tape that you were rewinding.
And they're a very common native finch. They look like a scoop of raspberry ice cream, the males do, with that beautiful, beautiful red head. And you find them nesting at pretty much most elevations, mostly common more towards lower elevations and clear cuts, and very common out at the Claylock Lodge around the river mouth there. Quite easily discriminated from our next species,
which is the house finch.
The house finch, a little bit more of a chirpy call, not quite as fast. You can discriminate individual notes a little bit more. Occasionally have these very little birdy little sounds within the call of the house finch.
And in terms of if you get a visual of these birds, is the house finch smaller than the purple finch?
I believe they're about the same size. It's actually a field mark that's challenging to denote in the field. Your best bets are by habitat and by their song, by their distinctive song.
And the habitat differentiation again?
You tend to see house finches a little bit more in humanized areas. Commonly get them at your bird feeders, in your fence rows and shrubby thickets, and oftentimes more open early successional areas, typically often at lower elevation.
Mm-hmm. And our last one is American goldfinch. It's such a treat to see them in flight. And aren't they one of the few that will call in flight?
You bet. You'll see them bounding along. Many of these finches, they're seed specialists, and they often tend to wander a little bit more than our other species of birds. They have their distinctive conical bills for cracking the husk of seeds, and they tend to have a bounding, undulating flight, and particularly the American goldfinch. When flight, it'll give these beautiful snippets of songs.
They almost sound like a cartoon bird to me. And they're just brilliant yellow with black on their head and white in the wings.
And they've certainly done well at the hands of humans, how we've modified the landscape. So they're common around our forest edges and fields. And here's their delicious song.
Oh, that's such a pleasure. That's all we have got time for today. So thank you so much once again. And that's a nice note to go out on, that American goldfinch, isn't it?
You bet. Hey, this has been really fun. And go forth and celebrate birds.
Thank you. There are a few upcoming natural history events to tell you about. First of all, it's free fishing weekend this Saturday and Sunday, the 9th and 10th of June, when no fishing license is required of anyone to fish in Washington. So get out there and enjoy your favorite river or lake or seashore, regardless of whether you catch anything or not.
On Saturday, June 9th, please join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society out of Squim for one of their backyard birder classes. Out of the Nest is the subject of the June class in the Backyard Birds series. Expert birders will present a program that includes the adult birds' role in feeding and caring for young birds, how young birds' food needs change as they grow, vulnerabilities of young birds, and how to make your home and property less hazardous to young birds. Different species have differing roles in raising their young. Learn to recognize these and help them thrive. Program will be offered in Dungeness River Audubon Center, Railroad Bridge Park, from 10 a.m. to noon. For more information, go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org.
And for the past 12 years, June has been proclaimed Orca Awareness Month by the Governor of Washington. And for the first time in 2016, it was celebrated by our neighbors in Oregon and British Columbia as well. There are a bunch of events scattered throughout our region to celebrate our wonderful orca. Go to orcanetwork.org for a full listing. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a black-headed grosbeak, and they are so named not because they have ugly bills, but because their bills are so large, which allows them to easily crack open seeds and even snail shells. They are medium-sized songbirds and a common summer resident in our area. The male is strikingly handsome, with a black head, rusty orange breast, nape, and rump, black back, wings, and tail, and white patches on its wings. The female is much more drab, looking like a large sparrow with a strong white eye stripe and inordinately large bill. The other grosbeak found in our area, the evening grosbeak, is less common at lower elevations, generally found near coniferous forest, and the male distinguished by a bright yellow eyebrow. The song of the black-headed grosbeak is a melodious, sweet series of slurred, whistled phrases, similar to an American robin song. It is often referred to as a drunken robin. If you listen carefully, you will notice that it is delivered at a faster pace than a robin's, however, and is both huskier and higher in pitch. Both the male and female sing, which is not uncommon for finch-like birds. The black-headed grosbeak is one of the few birds that can eat monarch butterflies, despite the noxious chemicals that the monarchs accumulate from their milkweed diet. Black-headed grosbeaks eat many monarchs on their wintering grounds in Mexico. Our thanks to the great CD collection Bird Songs of the Pacific Northwest for the recording. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of June. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and to Fred Sharp for helping train our ear up for a summer of fine birding. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptce.org. As always, happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Skyline Pigeon, performed by Elton John.
Just let me wake up in the morning, to the smell of new mown hay, to laughing.